Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a testimony today by the acting director of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, before the Senate Intelligence Committee, where he contradicted claims by the White House that Comey was unpopular with the rank and file at the FBI and cast doubts on President Trump's version of events in his letter, in which Trump claimed that Comey had assured him three times that he was not under investigation. Ali Watkins, a national security correspondent for Politico, joins us to discuss her latest articles at Politico, Comey firing threatened Senate probe into Trump's Russia ties, and Rosenstein meets with Senate intel leaders after Comey firing. We'll assess how much the Deputy Attorney General is prepared to break with the White House, given rumors that Rosenstein threatened to resign because Trump surrogates were pinning the blame for Comey's firing on him, and whether he could risk appointing a special prosecutor. Then we will speak with Asha Rangappa, a former special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation specializing in counterintelligence investigations. She is the associate dean at Yale Law School and teaches national security law at the Jackson Institute at Yale University, and joins us to discuss how the counterintelligence investigation into possible collusion between Trump and the Russians will continue. But it will take some time, and if and when the investigation is referred to the FBI Criminal Division for prosecution, the case against Trump could be weakened because a lot of sensitive evidence may be prevented from being aired in open court. Then finally, we'll examine the possibility of scandal fatigue helping Trump in the end, since after a little more than 100 days in office, his administration, with his family and businesses embedded in it, is already off the charts in generating headlines, scandal, smoking guns, shady deals, and a blizzard of lies. Mark Feldstein, a professor and chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland, who has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, and NBC, joins us to discuss the amazing double standard in terms of what Trump gets away with and Trump's critique of TV anchors he disapproves of. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, who's a national security correspondent for Politico, who previously covered national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News. And before that, she covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspapers DC Bureau. Her latest articles at Politico are Comey firing threatened Senate probe into Trump's Russia ties and Rosenstein meets with Senate intel leaders after Comey firing. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Watkins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thank you, Ali. And apparently the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, sort of slipped into the hearings today. The Senate was already conducting a hearing, and I take it that the Senator Burr, the chair, and the ranking member, Mark Warner, left the hearing and went into a private conference with Rod Rosenstein, who's become a very controversial figure as a result of him being sort of pretty much fingered by the White House as being the person who provided the justification for the firing of Comey, which apparently he disputes. So do you think that's what went on in this hearing? That I take it that Rosenstein pretty much on the defensive.
Yeah, I mean, what actually happened in the hearing, the only insight we have right now is that Senators Burr and Warner had a press conference immediately following their meeting with Rosenstein, and basically said that it had been a pre-scheduled meeting to just kind of update each other and deconflict both the FBI's investigation into Russia ties and the Senate Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russia ties. However, it obviously came in the backdrop of this hugely controversial thing that happened earlier this week with James Comey's firing. And we saw this kind of unprecedented scene of two key senators standing up in the middle of a televised briefing saying they needed to go to this meeting. So as to what actually came up in the Rosenstein meeting, we don't know that specifically yet. But I think it's probably a fair assumption that this was not a normal day-to-day check-in.
And the briefing that you're referring to was ostensibly a cross-the-board briefing on intelligence status and a kind of threat profile, for the want of a better description, around the world with all of the top intelligence leaders in attendance. But it seemed to be pretty much dominated, even though they didn't want to talk about it so much, by the fact that the acting FBI director, Andrew McCabe, was testifying. And that was certainly that's where the public interest is, right? Mm-hmm. So describe that, if you will.
Yeah, certainly. So the hearing that was happening today publicly is the annual hearing that the Intelligence Committee has. It's their annual open hearing, kind of going through all of the threat areas, and it actually tends to be really boring. But of course, we have this sensational backdrop for it this year. And even up until, my understanding, and up until early yesterday, they were unsure of, you know, Jim Comey was obviously supposed to be one of the intelligence community leaders there testifying. Comey was fired. There's a lot of jostling over whether they should invite McCabe, whether they should just nix the FBI slot. And so it was really kind of threw a wrench in this whole hearing. And obviously, almost all of the questioning focused in some way on Russia. And this, and specifically relating to Jim Comey's firing about 2 days ago.
So, what do you think is going on there, with in terms of what the real story is here with Rod Rosenstein? The impression I get is that he wrote up some kind of memo about his displeasure with Comey, going back some time, obviously. And then somehow the White House got hold of this, reworked it, added some language of Trump saying that he was assured three times that he wasn't under investigation by Comey, and then made public. That's the best explanation I can come up with, because we're told that Rosenstein was furious that he was being blamed, and that the White House press people were essentially saying it's all his idea, and Trump just went along with Rosenstein's recommendations. So what do we know about the extent to which he's upset about this? And I don't know the extent to which he's trying to clear the record, if indeed he can do that without going public.
So what we know as far as how Rosenstein has responded to all of this is that, just based on the reporting we have, that he was not happy to be effectively kind of thrown on the sword as the reason that Trump chose to fire Comey. So there were reports coming out late last night even saying that he had threatened to quit his job if the White House didn't correct the record. And obviously it sounds like what actually was the case is that Trump was always intent on firing Comey, but needed a reason kind of concocted, and used Rosenstein's memo, which doesn't explicitly advocate firing Comey, as a reason to do it. So from reporting, we know that that is an element of this story, is that Rosenstein was very unhappy. But he did, forgive me, I'm not exactly positive on the specifics, but Rosenstein said, either Rosenstein or DOJ said today that he had not, in fact, threatened to quit. But in between all this smoke, we know a couple things, that although this was a pre-scheduled meeting with the Senate Intelligence Committee, Rosenstein's office did reach out after the Comey issue, the Comey firing, to kind of emphasize this meeting and make sure it was still happening. And we know that Rosenstein was reaching out to Chuck Schumer on the Hill, and he was kind of trying to make these rounds. So there was clearly an effort that he was putting forth to kind of get in front of people, and perhaps, if these reports are correct, that he was very angry, to kind of put forth a full story as to what his role was.
Well, I suppose in the interview with NBC's Lester Holt today, Donald Trump did pretty much take responsibility, saying it, you know, he wanted to fire him, and he did fire him. Mm-hmm. So to that extent, I guess he's corrected the record. But my understanding is that Rosenstein wanted to clear the record with Chuck Schumer, and Schumer refused. He wants him to testify before the full Senate.
Schumer's pushing for them to get a full congressional briefing on the firing of Comey.
Right. So, again, I'm speaking with Ali Watkins, a national security correspondent for Politico, who previously covered national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News, and before that covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Her latest articles at Politico are Comey Firings Threatens Senate Probe into Trump's Russia Ties and Rosenstein Meets with Senate Intel Leaders After Comey Firing. So, in terms of how much it's going to impact the Russia inquiry, the deputy, who's now the acting head of the FBI, McCabe, made it clear that that was not the case, that the FBI will continue. But he did contradict the White House press people in the way they've spun the story by making it clear that morale was not in desperate shape at the FBI under Comey, that in fact they had a great deal of respect for him across the board. So what are the chances of the White House setting the record straight on that one at least?
Well, based on experience, I'd say not good. But it was, you know, McCabe made very clear in this hearing, he kind of had one of two options, right? And one was to kind of pick up the White House's story and carry it forward, or he did what most of us expected him to do, which was be very much a Bureau loyalist, which he is. And he's very much a Comey supporter. So everything that McCabe said kind of aligned with that, you know, that clear separation between the White House and the White House's version of events and the Bureau and the Bureau's version of events. And, you know, from everything that I've gathered, McCabe's descriptions are true. You know, Comey was well-respected. Comey was well-regarded. There was an implicit kind of trust that he had within that Bureau and within, you know, bipartisan characters on the Hill, the intelligence community, and beyond. So it was interesting as McCabe was starting to kind of give these certain assurances to the committee in that, you know, he agreed he would not tell the White House about anything related to the Russia probe. He would maintain the Russia probe's independence. He spoke a lot on Comey, clearly diverting from the White House narrative. A lot of us were like, well, he's signing his own pink slip. So the question to come down now is, how long does McCabe stay? And obviously he's sitting there saying that he's going to be a protector of this, of the Russia probe, very much as Comey was. But the question that kind of remains is almost not a matter of if, but when McCabe will actually get fired, given his very clear divergence from the White House today.
Well, of course, Senator Burr asked McCabe if he was aware of Mr. Comey telling President Trump three times that he was not under investigation, as Trump has claimed. He said he couldn't comment on private conversations. But I believe in subsequent questioning, he said that it would be highly unusual if it took place. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that is what I understand he did, too. And that was, I think, in the same questions, he said he would not answer any kind of questions from the White House of similar nature.
Right. But again, that is almost like, as you say, signing his pink slip. You know, it's not going to endear him to Trump, who appears to want absolute unwavering loyalty. But let's talk about McCabe a little. He, first of all, he's been accused of being the source of the FBI official who told Reince Priebus, when the New York Times broke the story about how foreign intelligence services have determined that there have been extensive connections between the Russians and aides for the Trump campaign, Page and Manafort, etc., and Flynn. And McCabe was supposed to have said to Reince, that's BS, that story's BS. And then that led Priebus to go and lean on both Burr and Devin Nunes, the chairs of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, to go public and refute the New York Times. So if that's the case, that's a little troubling. What do you know about that?
That whole incident, to me, is something that I've never really even been able to clearly parse out. As far as McCabe, generally, what we know about him, he's career FBI, and as I said, very much in Comey's camp, and kind of said as much at this hearing today. But there are these kind of little things. He's also involved in some kind of ethics probe because his wife, who was running for Congress in, I believe, Virginia, received money from a Clinton surrogate. So there's McCabe he has some of these weird baggage, I guess is a good way to explain it. But at the same time, well respected within the community.
But the New York Times is suggesting that he's not entirely popular with rank and file because he hasn't done a lot of field work and he's had something of a meteoric rise through the ranks. He's relatively young. Did you get a whiff of any of that? Because it's in contrast to, apparently, that the rank and file have a lot of respect for Comey, but not necessarily...
Frankly, I don't have a great pulse on what rank and file thinks about McCabe. It's more been the Comey side of things that I know better.
Well, we know from the reporting from the Washington Post that, and they interviewed over 30 agents, I believe, that there's a lot of anger over there about the firing of Comey. And I'm sure, do you expect an avalanche of leaks? Because already we've heard leaks that Comey apparently, when after Trump accused Obama of wiretapping him and called Obama a bad, sick guy, Comey is supposed to have said that he thinks that Trump is not dealing with reality and may be crazy. That's pretty strong stuff.
I mean, if the White House was trying to discourage leaks, this was probably not the best move.
Right. So you think that there's going to be some further, I mean, obviously we're not getting any testimony from Comey himself, and we're not likely to, I imagine. But what's your sense of what we really learn about the bottom line here is that the suspicion is that Trump really is trying to shut down the Russia probe, and that's what he wants. He just wants it to go away, and he wants to make it happen. And Comey allegedly was asked to shut it down and said no. I don't know whether that's been verified or not. So let's start with that. Have you heard any verification for that?
You know, I have not heard if there's been explicit pressure from the White House on Comey specifically or the FBI generally to shut down the Russia probe, but it was kind of a known fact that the White House really kind of desperately wanted this to go away. It's been that dark cloud that follows them. I mean, it'll ebb and flow. You know, we won't talk about it for a week, but then something else happens. So it's, you know, it was very obvious that it was kind of a political grenade. And the Bureau was kind of the one stuck mostly dealing with it.
But Trump himself could have gotten rid of it a long time ago by clearing the air, which he refuses to do. So,
no, certainly.
Yeah. So do you think that he can just, through sheer will and bullying his aides, who, you know, who do seem to be somewhat cowed by him, can he stop it, do you think? I mean, that's from the testimony today from McCabe, that doesn't look to be the case, but I imagine there are ways that you can, behind the scenes, slow things down.
I mean, I think it's kind of like, what part of it could he actually stop? I mean, if enough things happen, you know, if enough people would leave the Bureau, if he's able to really get people in there that he can manipulate, I find it very hard to believe that he could actually shut down that investigation. I would be shocked if he does, frankly. But even if something would happen where he's able to kind of tamp down on it in some way, which, again, I highly doubt, I think you would see a lot of people coming forward through unofficial channels to talk about this. This is something that I think has, even taking the Trump angle out of it and the political side of the Russia story out of it, the Russian attempts to manipulate the U.S. election is something that has shaken, I think, across the political spectrum, people within the intelligence community. And I don't think that Trump is ever going to be able to make that go away.
Well, just in closing then, what do you think in terms of pressure on Rosenstein to appoint a special prosecutor? He does have the ability, since his boss, the Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has recused himself. He's apparently very unhappy that he's been sort of the White House has pinned the blame on him for getting Comey fired. So what would your prediction be there? I mean, he's got the power to do it, right? But it would be a huge rebuke of the White House, would it not?
It would be a huge rebuke of the White House. And I also, I'm outside of optics, I'm confused. Not necessarily confused. I struggle to see how a special prosecutor necessarily fixes the problem, which is that a special prosecutor would obviously not impede, and frankly would be a very good look for Rosenstein if he's really trying to show this independent streak. But there still remains the same problem, that a special prosecutor would be under the umbrella of the administrative branch. And you, as he fired Jim Comey, as Nixon fired the special prosecutor in 72, there the White House could put as much pressure on a special prosecutor as they can on the Bureau. So I think that's something that I'm sure Rod Rosenstein is probably thinking a lot about. If I had to, like, pick an up or down bet, I would actually, I think with time, a special prosecutor will probably be the route that they go. Total hypothesis on my part, but I don't know if it'll be immediate, but I do think that at some point it will probably be a direction that Rosenstein decides to go.
But in the meantime, the House Intelligence Committee is in disarray, and the Senate is understaffed and underfunded, as is the House. And Comey apparently asked Rosenstein for more funds because of the expanding Russia probe. So that seems to be, the purse strings seem to be a way to slow things down. Any likelihood that Rosenstein could give more resources? And, you know, I'm not sure why Burr can't get more resources. Apparently they've only got 7 part-time people working on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
You know, as far as resources go, a lot of those stories are not entirely accurate. The Intelligence Committee probe is actually moving forward at a pretty steady clip at this point. They just subpoenaed Mike Flynn yesterday. They're moving towards examining the more Trump-centric figures in this Russia story. And the resources with the Comey thing, as far as Comey's request for more resources, we reported yesterday this conversation that he had with the Intelligence Committee about what he actually needed from DOJ. He needed more, he lacked access to prosecutors, which was his real gripe. And that's what he said was kind of slow rolling their probe. He didn't have anybody at DOJ he could go to. He needed more access to federal prosecutors. And he additionally relayed that he was confident that under Rosenstein, since he had met with Rosenstein, he was confident he was going to be provided those resources. Of course, a couple of days later, Rosenstein's memo was cited in firing him. So there was clearly a breakdown there. But as far as resources go, at least on the Senate side, things seem to be moving along.
Well, Ali Watkins, I thank you very much for joining us, and I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a national security correspondent for Politico, who previously covered national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News, and before that covered national security for the Huffington Post and McClatchy Newspapers DC Bureau. Her latest articles at Politico are Comey firing threatened Senate probe into Trump's Russia ties and Rosenstein meets with Senate intel leaders after Comey firing. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back speaking with a former special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation specializing in counterintelligence investigations. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Asha Rangappa, who's the Associate Dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University, the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University, and she previously served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City. Welcome to Background Briefing, Asha Rangappa.
Thank you.
And there seems to be quite a contradiction between what the White House has said in terms of how the FBI weren't happy with Director Comey. White House spokesman Sarah Huckabee Sanders said on Wednesday that there were countless FBI employees that had lost faith in Mr. Comey's leadership. But you're certainly not hearing that from reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and indeed from the testimony today from the deputy head of the FBI who testified today before the Senate Intelligence Committee Andrew McCabe. He was actually, I think he went a long way to contradict what the White House was saying. So it doesn't look as if on his first day, Andrew McCabe is endearing himself to the White House.
Yes. No, it does not appear that at all. Comey, as far as I'm aware, was very well liked within the Bureau. He was a welcome addition to the agency. I think he came in with a very high reputation and was well regarded, regardless of political affiliation. He came with this kind of legendary story about standing up for the rule of law and having a lot of integrity. So he also developed very personal relationships with agents. I believe that he made a personal trip to every single field office after he was appointed as director as a way of actually meeting agents on the ground and the leaders at those field offices. And I think that that went a long way toward creating a sense of mutual trust with him and the agents working at the Bureau.
And in terms of his replacement, Andrew McCabe, the New York Times is saying that he's considered a skilled briefer. He was something of a wunderkind at the FBI, rising quickly through the organization, but not universally loved among agents because he hadn't done a lot of field work. Is there a cultural difference between sort of head office people and field work people within the FBI?
A little bit. There's a certain point of pride that agents will take when they don't go into management because you're working active cases. And once you get on a supervisory track that kind of takes you up the ranks, either from supervising a squad within a field office to moving up the chain and heading up a field office itself, up to going to headquarters, you're not actually doing the investigative work, you're overseeing the investigative work. And I think there is a certain divide on that front that if someone hasn't really done casework for a certain period of time, that they may not have the requisite background to be overseeing those cases. And I think whether or not that's true really depends on the person in question. So, but yes, there's definitely a little bit of a divide there.
So what's your sense of whether the firing of Comey, and it's pretty hard not to assume that it has something to do with the Russian inquiry. Certainly the excuses that were given by the White House that this had to do with his handling of Hillary Clinton's emails, which, as we all recall, Donald Trump praised him at the time for that last-minute letter. That doesn't really hold much credibility. So if indeed it is the obvious that it has something to do with Trump's unhappiness with the Russia probe, what's your sense as a former FBI counterintelligence investigator? What do you think will happen to that? Because I believe the main investigation is with the counterintelligence division of the FBI.
Yes. My guess is that the main investigation is a counterintelligence investigation, which could lead to certain criminal charges if evidence is uncovered in the course of that information that specific people violated U.S. law. At this point, I believe that this investigation has progressed to a stage where it will continue. You know, an investigation of this scale, and particularly one that's under the kind of scrutiny that this one is under, would have at this point generated just too much intelligence. There are open electronic surveillance orders out that's generating intelligence. That intelligence is being shared within the intelligence community. There are questions that are raised in the course of this investigation that generate leads that are sent to other field offices. So you basically have a kind of a national investigation to some extent going on. And that's going to continue. These are investigations that are conducted pursuant to
certain rules and regulations that are called Attorney General guidelines. There is a structure in place. There's an organization in place. So it's not something that can just suddenly stop.
So we've been told that Director Comey asked the Deputy Attorney General, who's acting in pretty much in charge of the Russia investigation, because the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, has recused himself. We're told that Director Comey wanted more resources, and whether or not that was agreed to, we don't know, because he was subsequently fired, a couple of days later. But one of the reports indicate that what he was really asking for were more prosecutors. What does that tell us?
Well, I find that interesting. I would think that there would be more resources needed on the investigative side if this inquiry is continuing. Again, I think this is primarily a counterintelligence investigation. If there is evidence that Russia has attempted to influence the election, the focus of the investigation would be on what were they doing? How did they do it? What is their network here? What kind of sources do they have? What kind of techniques are they using? How can we shore up our defenses to stop this? I think the secondary issue would be on bringing criminal charges. And I think that would actually come much later, if at all. And typically that would come, in my opinion, on offenses that probably wouldn't reveal the scope of the actual attempts that Russia may have made against us from an intelligence perspective. We wouldn't want to reveal that in a criminal case. So you might see charges like lying to federal agents, making false statements, obstruction of justice, that type of thing, rather than charges brought on classic under espionage statutes. So if he was asking for more prosecutors, that would surprise me, because that would seem to suggest both a more advanced stage of this investigation, which would be surprising to me, and also a greater focus on the criminal aspect of it, which would also be surprising to me, only again at this stage and what such an investigation would typically generate in terms of criminal charges.
Well, apparently on the day after the inauguration, the first day in the White House, or the second day in the White House, I guess, the FBI interviewed General Flynn. And we know from the recent testimony by Sally Yates, the phrase was used a lot about General Flynn's underlying conduct. It was used several times, and General Clapper also used that same phrase. And it's led a lot of people to speculate that there's a real smoking gun in all of that stuff. So when you consider that was, it's been a little over 100 days, right, since Donald Trump's been president, what's the normal timeline, if there's such a thing as a normal timeline? Because I think the investigation started, back in June of last year? Or do you have any idea when the first inkling of Russian interference came across the FBI's radar?
My understanding is that first inkling came up, I think, last June or July, is what I believe the director said. I don't think there is a typical timeline. It really depends on the kind of information that's uncovered in the course of the counterintelligence investigation and how much of that the counterintelligence division is willing to share with the criminal side in order to bring charges. Because once again, our criminal trials are public. So once, you know, to the extent that information that's gleaned in the counterintelligence investigation becomes the basis for the criminal investigation, that's something that the FBI is going to have to lay out on the table. And it may not be willing to do that in certain circumstances. Now with Mike Flynn, once again, he could be a threat based on information that has been uncovered in the counterintelligence investigation. But if he's charged with something like providing false information on his SF-86, which would be his background form, or making false statements to federal officials, those are pretty serious violations that carry some significant penalties, but proving them would only require the FBI to reveal a fairly limited amount of evidence that may not even be directly related to the counterintelligence investigation. But they can kind of still get him, if you will, and kind of and they found a way perhaps to do that. But I don't know. In my experience, these kinds of cases typically do not generate criminal charges. And I think only it's hard to say in this case what will come of it beyond what we know so far.
Well, it's already been reported in the open sources that Carter Page was, in effect, recruited, or at least there's an attempt to recruit him by SVR agents in New York. And supposedly, according to the reporting that I've heard and seen, that the FBI somehow got bugs inside binders that the FSB guys or the SVR guys were using. And they were able to get this extraordinary conversations about the Russians talking about Carter Page and how he was greedy and ambitious and how he was the kind of guy that they could recruit. So based upon what we've heard so far, it looks as if they've got some pretty deep hooks into what the Russians are up to. I think they kicked those guys out of the country, by the way, the Russians.
Sure. No, I have no doubt. The Russian counterintelligence program in the FBI is probably the oldest program in the counterintelligence division. I mean, that's been around since the FBI's inception. That was Hoover's focus. So those agents know what they're doing, and they will go after the Russians. And the Russians have been, you know, even after the Cold War, have, you know, mounted operations. We expelled 10 Russian agents who were here without official cover in 2010. You know, so we've been working and uncovering their efforts, and I'm sure that the FBI has responded aggressively. Again, I think the question on the criminal side is, what methods and sources are they willing to reveal in order to bring criminal charges? So, you know, the microphones and binders, if that's already out there and it's been disclosed or reported, then maybe at this point the FBI has nothing to lose in using that. But again, in a criminal investigation, they have to prove every element of the crime. So if they want to prove that someone was acting as a foreign agent for another country, for example, without registering. I mean, that's Foreign Agent Registration Act is a fairly weak statute. It only carries a 5-year prison penalty. So I don't know that would be the one that the FBI would want to use, but they would need to prove that, and they would need to reveal in court how they got the information that demonstrates that. So I think both things can be true, that they are aggressively countering the Russians, and the goal there would be to stop the capability of the Russians to conduct their intelligence activities here. And then afterwards, to the extent that they can disclose anything in a criminal investigation without compromising the counterintelligence goals, they will do that.
Well, of course, a lot has been made about contacts both with the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, and with General Flynn, with the ambassador, the Russian ambassador, Kislyak. And it's rumored that he's actually what they call a resident, you know, not with the Russian Foreign Ministry. In other words, he's not a part of, like Lavrov is, of the diplomatic side, but he's actually
the head of the intelligence.
The intelligence, yeah. And yeah. So is that something you've also heard?
That I don't know what he's been designated. Obviously, there was attention on him, and one can deduce that there was surveillance on him as a target, in which certain communications were picked up. And typically, that kind of electronic surveillance would be targeted to someone who was believed to be engaging in clandestine foreign intelligence activity. So that would make sense to me based on what we know of what's been reported about the kinds of communications that we have from him.
Well, but just in closing, though, if that's the case, and it does seem to be the case, at least there's a lot of focus on Kislyak, then what did you make of him being, you know, shown up at the White House with the Foreign Minister Lavrov and big smiles with Donald Trump? By the way, the only way we've seen these pictures is because they wouldn't let the American press in. They only let the Russian press into the White House. But the long and the short of it is, this is happening at the very moment that, or shortly thereafter, Donald Trump has fired the head of the FBI, who's looking into this Russian probe. And there you have all these smiles all around with a big target of the probe, Kislyak, along with Lavrov and Donald Trump.
Well, it's definitely, I don't know what to make of it. I mean, it's strange, and it's probably not great operational security to allow Russians to bring any kind of technical equipment into the Oval Office, I would say, from an FBI counterintelligence perspective. Yeah, the timing definitely from a perception standpoint is not good. And, you know, it adds to the questions that are raised from the timing of Comey's firing.
So just in closing then, Ajay Rangappa, what do you think? You're cautioning us to expect something soon, but assuming that something is passed from counterintelligence to the criminal division, then the FBI would then, what, have a grand jury? Would that would be the procedure? Because already the Senate Intelligence Committee is subpoenaing General Flynn, and I think they can also bring charges, can they not?
I'm sorry, who bring charges?
Can the Senate Intelligence Committee also bring charges, or does only the FBI can bring charges?
So it's the Department of Justice that brings charges.
Right.
The congressional committees are not empowered to bring charges. That's my understanding, unless, you know, if they have a special, you know, if even a special prosecutor in that, I'm thinking it through, would be appointed through the Department of Justice. So any kind of charging entity would emanate from the Department of Justice. And yes, once the criminal process starts, it will follow the normal process of any, you know, criminal investigation and prosecution. So, and that will happen at a public level. So that's something that would be reported and more transparent as it moves along.
Well, Ajay Rangappa, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I mean speaking with Ajay Rangappa, who's an associate dean at Yale Law School, who teaches national security law and related courses at Wesleyan University and at the Jackson Institute for Global Affairs at Yale University. Previously, she served as a special agent at the Federal Bureau of Investigation, specializing in counterintelligence investigations in New York City. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and the chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. He's the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Always great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thanks, Mark. And we're a little over 100 days in with the new Trump administration, and it's been almost like a scandal a day it's when you talk about Washington scandal culture from the point of view of going back to Richard Nixon and Jack Anderson, there's no way in the world. This guy's gone right off the charts, hasn't he? And do you think the cumulative effect of so much scandal is just sort of numbing us all to the point where perhaps we're just accepting the unacceptable?
I think yes on both counts. Yes, he's off the charts, and yes, it becomes sort of numbing. Except that it's more than just scandal. I mean, we are now reaching issues of maybe not a constitutional crisis yet, but potential abuses of power and allegations of covering up a criminal conspiracy with the dismissal of the FBI director. That really is Nixonian, and it's a parallel.
And do you think then that it's time for a serious discussion about impeachment?
Well, that's not going to happen with the Republican Congress. I mean, I question whether there'll even be an independent investigation with the Republican Congress. That's the thing many people forget about Watergate, that the evidence that implicated Richard Nixon, the tapes that showed he committed these felonies, would not have surfaced if there hadn't been a Congress run by the opposition running the investigation. In this case, we have Congress run by the same party that has been very deferential to Trump. And while there may be a handful of people occasionally willing to cross the aisle, I don't see at this point there the will to issue subpoenas and do the kind of full-throated investigation that Congress would need to do for impeachment to be successful.
So if the Republicans in the House and Senate are being craven, which they appear to be, and it's hard to know what their threshold of embarrassment is, what do you think it's going to take to basically put them in a situation where he's more of a liability? I mean, I take it that the reason they're going along with him, even if they don't necessarily find it comfortable with this daily dose of chaos and scandal, they're getting their agenda enacted. But the more this White House becomes dysfunctional, the less likely they are to get their agenda enacted. Wouldn't that be logical?
No, I think you're right. That's exactly what's happening. But I'm not sure getting the agenda enacted is the number one priority for most of these members of Congress. I think their number one priority is getting reelected. And so I think as long as Trump retains that base of 30%+ that support him, Republican members of Congress are going to be reluctant to challenge him for fear of losing those voters and having a primary challenger that would keep them from getting reelected. So I think until you see a change in public sentiment turn against Trump, even with his policy failures, you're going to have Republican members of Congress hanging on.
Well, the Republicans have gerrymandered, and they've got very safe districts. But 20 of them voted against the repeal and replace of Obamacare because they're worried. It'll only take 23, I think, to flip the House. But on the Senate side, because they have to represent the whole state, you would think that maybe the Republican senators are a little leery. Because Trump's going down and down in his approval ratings. They've just dropped again, I think, to about 35%.
That's true, although, that is easily reversible with some kind of a foreign policy crisis. Not that I'm hoping for that, obviously, but so those numbers could change. If they do go low enough, then you will see some spine by the Republican members of Congress. If, by some miracle, the FBI is actually able to conduct an independent investigation that really uncovers a criminal conspiracy, that, too, could change the dynamics. But I think short of either that kind of evidence or that kind of collapse of Trump's popularity, the Republican Congress is going to continue to back him despite their reservations.
So let's try and put Trump in the context. I mean, the last scandal, of course, which you wrote about in your book, was Watergate, and there was references to Watergate in terms of comparisons with the Saturday Night Massacre when Nixon fired the Attorney General, then the Deputy Attorney General, and then the third guy to step up to the plate was Robert Bork. Those comparisons are flying around with the Comey firing. But again, it just seems like, you know, Nixon, of course, people were appalled when the tapes came out, that of his salty language. They thought that was unpresidential. But my God, Trump has broken the mold of being unpresidential beyond, off the charts. So it seems to me that those comparisons really fall flat.
Well, Nixon didn't, you know, have to resign because he was unpresidential. He resigned because there was evidence that he engaged in a criminal conspiracy to cover up the Watergate break-in. And if evidence was to emerge that proved Trump was guilty of of felonies, I think he would be impeached too. The question I have is whether if such felonies have been committed, whether that will ever come out. Because with Comey's sacking and with the Republican Congress, there's much less reason to believe that the truth will come out. In Nixon's case, he had much less control over the mechanisms of government. He could not control the opposition party that ran Congress. And there was Mark Felt and others in the FBI who proved to be pretty loose cannons, busy leaking what they could, and the FBI agents, you know, following up on the trail. And maybe the FBI will do the same thing now, even without Comey. And we can all hope that's the case, but we can't bet on it.
So how does it relate then to the way people react to somebody being exposed as a hypocrite? For example, when the Access Hollywood tapes came out, you'd think, my God, that should be enough to sink him. But Trump has never been a kind of pious, family values type like the Christian right politicians. So is that what it takes? In other words, do the public give him a little more leeway because of his background? I mean, after all, he did get the vote of the Christian right, which is in itself somewhat puzzling. But is that what it takes? That, in other words, if you're proven to be a hypocrite, I believe the old adage in politics is never be caught in bed with a dead girl or a live boy. So is that the threshold we're talking about?
Well, it's hard to know what the threshold is with Donald Trump. I mean, that's the thing that's so perplexing here, is he seems to have broken all the old, defied all the rules of political gravity. Not only would the Access Hollywood tape have, killed any other candidate. I mean, just from the get-go, with him impugning John McCain, a hero of the Republican Party, as being some kind of loser because he was a prisoner of war. I mean, that would have, totally, destroyed anyone else. So it's hard to know what's going to work with him, short of, actual, evidence of criminal actions or his numbers tanking.
Well, I spoke with someone the other day who made the point that if Obama and his family had gone to China while he was president and tried to promote the family business by offering green cards to Chinese investors, he would have been impeached and run out of town in a heartbeat. So
yes, and
So what's going on?
And Hillary Clinton too.
Right. So in the same, if Clinton would have done that too. So what explains that double standard?
I think there is a degree of loyalty among his base that almost defines logic and reason. It's almost like a cult membership. And I think you know, we can talk about the larger economic problems that, you know, help create that kind of desperation, but and the scapegoating that he has used and converted it to. But, you know, that combination of kind of populist authoritarianism seems to have built a loyalty that defies logic, certainly defies self-interest for much, if not all, of his base.
So what did you make of Donald Trump's venture into becoming a TV critic? We know that he watches TV all the time, and apparently over the weekend he was watching TV coverage, and the coverage of the Russian inquiry just got to him, apparently, and he had a tantrum, and that's why he fired Comey. But we know he watches TV a lot, and it's a strange situation, because I've often said that it's almost like an actor who's more interested in the reviews of the performance than the performance itself. But what did you make of his critique of, you know, Joe Scarborough saying he's got some problems, Chris Cuomo, he's sitting there like a chained lunatic, CNN in general not doing as well as others that are doing better, MSNBC, ridiculous, it's just bad, and then Stephen Colbert, a no-talent guy, there's nothing funny about what he says, and of course the one that... to some extent, I agree with CNN's Don Lemon, perhaps the dumbest person in broadcasting. So how's that like?
Well, there's a lot of competition for that mantle, Ian, I have to say.
Right. Well, needless to say, the Fox people all got praised. That goes without saying. So how's that likely to play? I mean, you think it's but for a guy that wants to get good coverage, it doesn't seem like the smartest thing to do.
No, but it's just a continuation of what he's been doing from the get-go. I mean, the pettiness of it all, you know, for a president is pretty astounding. And, you know, when the Nixon tapes were made public and he made similar comments, the country was shocked and horrified. But Nixon at least did it in private. He wasn't expecting that to become public. Trump openly, you know, says and does these things, not only publicly, he initiates them. He tweets them. So it's this culture of narcissism that we're in, and social media where every last burp is shared with the world. You know, we're getting to see who he really is, and it's not pretty. And he, by the way, he's not even a particularly good media critic, you know, not very articulate. But, you know, if he just stuck to that instead of his day job, we might all be better off.
Well, Mark Feldstein, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Pleasure as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein, who's a professor and a chair of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. He's the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and The Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.